Welcome to another installment of the Texas Observer podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara, and I have with me Melissa Del Bosque, staff writer for The Observer. How are you doing, Melissa?
I'm doing good, thanks.
We also have staff writer Patrick Michaels. Patrick?
Hi.
How's it going?
Good.
And staff writer Forrest Wilder, who wrote a very interesting piece. God knows why he decided to write about this. A solar panel piece.
Yeah.
Forrest, what's up with that, man? Why'd you write about solar panels?
It just has to do with my sunny disposition. I felt like it was time. No, I mean, right. I know, like, the Observer's sort of notorious sometimes for writing really heavy, dark, tragic pieces. But occasionally we do. Melissa, you know, the Juarez Valley of Death. But occasionally, we write this positive story, and this is my turn to take a whack.
This is your positive contribution.
Exactly. I haven't written a whole lot about the renewable energy sector, but while all the headlines in the past year or so have been dominated by Solyndra, this is the Department of Energy-backed company that failed, and solar energy and renewables have become hyper-politicized, especially in Washington, D.C., there's this fascinating backstory that I wanted to write about just how much the price of solar panels and solar energy has become in the last decade. I mean, the costs have really plummeted to the point that now, arguably, solar power is competitive with traditional forms of energy, and Texas in particular has the opportunity to be a major player on the national and global stage in solar power, like we are in wind. So I really wanted to tell that story, and I went where, in this state, where most of the action is, which is Austin, and really San Antonio is now becoming a big player.
Why is Texas, you know, on the cusp of being a major solar player?
I mean, a lot of it has to do with just being blessed, I guess, with certain natural characteristics that lend itself to this type of energy. Lots of cheap, flat land, lots of sun. That's probably the most important ingredient if you want to make electricity from solar. If you want to do solar power, the most important thing is have a lot of sunlight. We got plenty of sunlight, especially out in West Texas. We're a fast-growing state with major power demands, and in particular, we have a problem with not necessarily having enough power online during times of peak power demand, like in these really hot summer days where we've had rolling blackouts or come really close to having power outages, and that's a time when solar can do really well. It does best during hot summer days when power demand is at its peak.
We talked about a lot of these topics in a public panel that Forrest helmed last week, actually, at UT. And one of the most interesting things I heard about that was the difference between a brownout and a blackout.
Yeah.
Can you go into that for a second? I believe Mayor Bill White was talking about it.
Well, he probably would give a much better definition than I can. Blackout is basically when you have a total loss of power and the lights go out. A brownout is when you have a change in voltage, and so the lights will flicker or they'll dim. I mean, if you've ever been to Guatemala or Mexico, for example, you know, sometimes the power goes out and sometimes the light just kind of gets dim for a second. I think that's a change in voltage. You want to have a efficient, high-functioning grid, you want to maintain, I think it's like 60 hertz frequency so that everything's kosher.
Big money question. If Texas is right for solar and it makes sense and we have the right sort of environment for it, why don't we see solar panels on all rooftops?
Well, I mean, part of the reason is that it has been pretty expensive for a long time, and only now is it becoming to the point where it's going a little bit more mainstream because it makes not just environmental sense but economic sense. Still, the biggest barrier for homeowners putting solar panels in their house is that the upfront cost is still substantial, even after subsidies in Austin, San Antonio, and some other places, and a federal tax incentive. There's not that many people that have a few thousand bucks sitting around that they're willing to spend to put solar panels in their house. So where the market has really exploded and I'll just talk about the U.S. There's some different models in Europe and Japan. But where the market's really exploded in the U.S., California and New Jersey, for example, they have policies where companies will come in and pay for the panels outright. So the homeowner has to put nothing up front, and the homeowner essentially is leasing their rooftop to a company and then purchasing the power from the solar panel company for a below the retail rate. And so I think it's like 70 or 80% of the growth in California is coming from these third-party leasing models. And the exact business model, differs. In Texas, we don't really have that. We don't have the right policies in place. And so these companies just don't do business here. Nonetheless, there's still a lot of growth that's happening despite that.
But don't come to Texas to do business?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they want to. This is the second biggest state. Like I said, booming population, a lot of sun. It'd be a good place. The legislature has not been particularly friendly or helpful to the solar industry for a whole variety of reasons. I'd say primarily because there's an ideological mindset now that government shouldn't pick winners and losers in the private sector. Therefore, we're not going to lift a finger or especially spend any money to help this nascent industry. They'll have to figure it out on their own, despite, historical subsidies for oil and gas and that are ongoing.
So we also have a huge oil and gas lobby here that's very powerful.
Yeah. I mean, I think, wind power in Texas, we're now the national leader, thanks in part to the Texas legislature and George W. Bush in 1999 signed a law creating a renewable portfolio standard that helped kind of jumpstart this industry. And they're arguably the same could be done for solar. It just doesn't seem likely that it's going to happen in the short to midterm. So solar's going to have to figure out how to do its thing pretty much on its own with maybe some help from some of the bigger cities.
So from a resident, from like a homeowner perspective, what are the incentives that I have for installing solar panels, assuming that I have the upfront costs?
Yeah, well, in the city of Austin and also in San Antonio, there's some pretty generous rebates that pay for roughly, I think 30 to 50% of the upfront costs. And then after that, there's a 30% federal tax credit that kicks in. So you can bring the cost of a typical unit down substantially. So I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think you can purchase a good sized unit now for below $10,000, and now there's financing available through credit unions, so you can finance it over time. So your monthly impact is going to be fairly low, and then once it's paid off, then basically you're getting electricity not exactly for free, but at a greatly reduced discount. The payback periods can be as low as like 6 or 7 years for a homeowner. But again, it's still a hurdle for most people, and until Texas does make some changes to allow this third-party leasing arrangement, we're going to continue to see some pretty explosive growth in terms of year-over-year percentages, but getting, just a lot of megawatts on homeowners' rooftops to the extent that it's going to make a big impact on statewide energy consumption is probably not going to happen. For some time until those policy changes occur. Really, and to me, it's like, I think rooftop distributed generation is a certain beauty to it, and it has some advantages that utility scale solar doesn't, but if you want to, just in terms of scale, it's really going to require utilities or merchant companies going out and building huge solar farms to make solar a big player in terms of like installed, megawatts when compared to like coal or nuclear or even wind.
Which is what you describe in the piece.
Right.
So who are the people who are doing that in San Antonio?
Well, San Antonio it's the first or second biggest city-owned utility in the country. And they have, I think over 700,000 customers. It's a vertically integrated utility. It's essentially a monopoly. And most of Texas, outside of, San Antonio, Austin, El Paso and a few other places, it's a deregulated market. So San Antonio is a little bit of an exception. One of the interesting things, though, is they're able to like leverage the size of their utility, the stability, the great credit rating that they have to do some things that that companies aren't willing to or can't do in the deregulated market. And so and they're also able to establish, you know, policy goals based on things other than narrow economic interests. So San Antonio has really become, just in the past few years, a much bigger player, giving Austin a bit of a run for its money in terms of renewable energy, conservation, and efficiency measures. And so San Antonio is on its way, or if it hasn't already, to surpassing Austin also in solar. So they built one solar farm. There's another one, I believe, that's under construction. And then the really big play is this 400 megawatt facility, which is a pretty big, you know, it's a pretty big power plant, where they required bidders for this, who wanted to build this facility, to establish a manufacturing center in San Antonio. So they would manufacture the solar panels there, also guarantee a certain level of investment and a certain number of jobs. And they chose last year this company, I think it was earlier this year, a company called OCI Solar, which is a Korean-owned company. So they're going to move, if this thing goes through, which it's supposed to, not only will they build a 400-megawatt power plant, they're going to have a factory in San Antonio where they're going to crank out solar panels, not just for that facility, but presumably for sale to, you know, willing buyers wherever they may be.
Residents included?
Well, and it may also feed into the local residential rooftop market, which is, sort of a little bit of a different animal than this utility-scale project. But it's all kind of tied together and integrated. So it's kind of an interesting deal. I think there's some risk that it may not work out. A lot of these deals that seem to pencil don't actually work out in fruition, partially because this industry is evolving so rapidly, the cost declines are occurring so precipitously that a lot of companies just get their feet cut out from underneath them. And in fact, that's kind of what happened with Solyndra. Like, it was a obviously it was a kind of a bummer that the taxpayers lost this $500 million loan. But on the other hand, a failure of this one company is actually, in a weird way, a sign of success for this global industry, solar panel manufacturing. So I guess what I was trying to do is tell a little bit more of a nuanced story about this particular renewable energy sector that's, not just about like this one company's failure, which I think is what most Americans actually think about and know about solar now.
Some more nuance than just shouting the word Solyndra over
and over. Yeah, exactly. And that's, it's really frustrating with the cable news environment. It's like, it's just this touchstone, this magic word that's supposed to conjure up all these things for one team or one side. And then, it's a pretty simple-minded and silly kind of narrative, so let's try to do something a little bit more complex than that.
Well, I think you've certainly shed some light on this for me.
Yes. Well, yeah.
No pun intended.
Totally intended. Well, you can read more about solar panels in Forrest's article, The Sun Will Come Out Tomorrow. I'm sorry, Patrick, I'm not going to sing that title.
The sun will come out tomorrow.
Thank you, Melissa, for that. You can find that online at texasobserver.org. And for now, we're going to start talking about the DREAM Act, which Melissa has been writing about a lot lately. And why? Is there something going on with that we should know about, Melissa?
I have to say, I was pleasantly surprised last Friday and amazed by President Obama's executive order to allow for DREAM Act students to have basically two-year work permits and not to have to fear deportation. Immigration lawyers have contacted me, and just to clarify, you don't want to say this is a visa. That's not what it is. But what it is basically him telling these kids, and we're talking anywhere from 800,000 to 1.4 million kids, that you don't have to worry about getting deported and that you can work legally, which is huge. It's not what, they're all, DREAM Act kids are ultimately hoping for, which is something more permanent and reliable. I think President Obama, in his address after the decree, called it a stopgap measure, and that's really what it is.
So who exactly are the students that it covers, then? Just to define.
It covers, I say kids. I mean, these are, you know, mostly teenagers, young adults, under the age of 30, and you have to have been in the country for more than 5 years, and it's for kids. Yeah.
But you have to have come here when you're 16 or younger, right?
Right, right, and you have to have come here when you were 16 or younger and have been here for 5 years and be under the age of 30. And you can be in the military or enrolled in school. So those are the people who qualify.
But can't you have already graduated from high school?
I believe,
right?
So also.
You
should
have completed your education or be enrolled.
And there's still a lot of questions, and that's really what a lot of people who might qualify for this work permit are talking about right now, is the specifics of how exactly it's going to work. So there's a lot of excitement, but there's also a lot of, some skepticism. Like, is this really going to work? Because there's a lot of different things tied to whether they're going to qualify or not. And then, you know, you've got this two-year window, and then what's going to happen after that? I think they were saying it would be renewable, but it's really not certain.
So what are the details that are up in the air?
Well, some things that are going around right now in immigration advocacy groups is the Department of Homeland Security is asking for a lot of paperwork, like background checks and criminal record checks and proof that you're, you know, in school or have a graduate degree or that you're in the military. There's a lot of paperwork that needs to be done and go through the system before you can get this work permit. And there's also a real worry that you know, people are going to take advantage of these kids, you know, and tell them they can help them and end up ripping them off. And so there's a lot of warnings that don't get wrapped up in some fraudulent, you know, business who says they're going to help you do the background check or the other things that they're going to need to pass through the Homeland Security process. So, I mean, having personally dealt with the immigration system in the past, it's never easy dealing with the system with an immigration visa or anything like that. It takes a long time, and you have to be very patient, and it doesn't always work out. So you know, kids have to take it with a grain of salt.
What do you make of this, like, the criticism, one of the criticisms of Obama has been, twofold. One, that this isn't something you should do through an executive order, but this is something that Congress should take up. And some people have gone so far as to suggest that it's unconstitutional to issue an executive order like this. And then two, and this one I find much less convincing, I guess, which is that he's playing politics in election year and trying to win Latino voters, which that's what politicians do. So I don't really see why that's such an issue. But what do you make of that first thing? I mean, at least in the sense that would it be better if Congress acted on the DREAM Act or some measure like this?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, and they need to, and that's what he came out and said in his address from the Rose Garden, was that, you know, this is a stopgap measure. I'm doing all that I can do without Congress because Congress isn't taking any action on this, and it's gotten to the point where it's really pretty ridiculous. I mean, they've brought up the DREAM Act so many times since 2001, and it's nearly passed, but it's always fails by, you know, 5 votes or filibuster or something, and so then, you know, everybody's left waiting for the next round of the DREAM Act, and it just seems to have gotten more protracted and worse as the decade has progressed, to the point now where they don't even bring it up anymore. So, I mean, President Obama came out in his address and said, look, this is just a temporary fix, and Congress needs to act on this, and if I mean, it's up to them to actually pass the law. So that.
So what happens in 2 years?
Well, that's the thing. Without Congress passing something, this is really just a kind of, you know, a temporary fix. And it doesn't provide much security to these families, because are you going to hire somebody who's got this strange provisional 2-year work permit and you're not sure if it will be renewed? I mean, I think they're still going to have a tough time getting employed. But I have been really impressed with the DREAMS Act, with the movement, because it is so well organized and the kids are very well spoken and they're also very well educated. And it just seems a shame that the United States would not want to take a bunch of engineers and other highly qualified people. I mean, I know just off the top of my head a man in his early 20s who graduated with a biomedical engineering degree from UT, and he couldn't stay here any longer, so he went to Canada, and Canada took him. So, and I know another couple who had advanced degrees who went to Canada. So basically Canada's picking up all these highly educated people who came from our universities that, you know, Congress can't get its act together to allow to work here. So they're going to Canada, they're going to other countries. So we're educating them here, and then we're exporting these highly educated people.
Now, I know that you covered a rally at UT maybe 2 weeks ago, something like that?
It was on graduation. It was right before graduation, so about a month ago.
Have you been in contact with any of the kids that you met there? Students.
Yes. Yeah, I've talked to them. I talked to them last Friday after President Obama made the announcement, and they were very excited because the whole point of their rally that they had at UT before the graduation day was, you know, here we have these degrees and, you know, engineering and psychology and all these various fields, but we can't use them. So, you know, they're doing things like selling skin creams or working in a restaurant when they have these advanced degrees, and they could be starting their internships and they could be starting their careers. So it was sort of like this bittersweet moment, you know, because they were celebrating this huge achievement, but then they couldn't do anything with it. So they were very excited. I mean, this was like a huge release of a lot of pressure that I think a lot of families have been feeling for a long time. But then they're all now asking the question of what next, you know, and is this really going to solve some problems for us? And there's also this sense too that they really need to keep working to get Congress to pass the DREAM Act.
It's kind of, it's the political realm. It's put some folks kind of in the hot seat about what they actually believe on this particular policy, which it's sort of hard to beat up on, you know, people who, through no choice of their own, despite what Blake Farenthold may think about 16-year-olds, you know, came to this country because their parents brought them, and then came here and in the case of these kids, like, most of them succeeded, you know, very well on education or military. So, Mitt Romney's had a hard time explaining, actually sort of dodged the question of what he would do. You know, Marco Rubio, for example, who's the Cuban-American senator from Florida, has sort of had to really parse it that he's in favor of the gesture, but he would do something different, maybe in a different way, and then also criticizing it as only being a stopgap measure and promoting his own legislation in Congress. So do you think this change tip the balance at all towards more comprehensive immigration reform, or does it further deepen the kind of like partisan divide on immigration? What do you think, Melissa?
Well, I think it depends so much on how the primary voters receive it in the Republican Party, whether the anti-illegal immigration rhetoric still fires up people and turns them out in the primary, Republican primary. It seems now that the Republicans have been going on for the last decade about, you know, always promising the DREAM Act students, like, okay, you know, next year, or we're coming up with a plan, or we're coming up with a solution, and then it never ever materializes, and it's gotten to the point where it's almost ridiculous. You know, it's like, I don't think there's another storyline you can give us that we would believe at this point. I mean, what is Marco Rubio going to pull out of his, you know, magic hat and present that all, you know, Republicans are going to be happy with? I think they need to get beyond the political cycle, the 2-year political election cycle, 4-year cycle, and look at this reality and figure out how they're going to fix it and think about leadership rather than winning a political race.
It's kind of interesting, though. There's a Texas Tribune UT poll that came out a couple days ago, and it was comparing, like, what insiders here in Austin or around state government think are the top issues or priorities for the state compared to, like, voters or citizens. And it was in some cases, a pretty stark contrast. The top issue or issues for the citizenry were border security, immigration, and the economy. And those were pretty low ranking among the insiders. Insiders were more concerned about education, right? Water supply, transportation. And among Republicans in this state, which, you know, run the state, was even more strongly concerned about border security and immigration and the economy as well. So I thought that was interesting. It's still such a driving issue for so many people. There's sort of a disconnect, at least in state government, about what's a priority and what's not.
I think it's really linked to the economy, though. When the economy's bad, I think historically in the U.S., and I think in other countries too, people tend to want to circle the wagons, and they tend to lash out whoever is less powerful than they are. People who are not, you know, immigrants, people less powerful, people who they feel are taking their jobs. I mean, the common refrain I hear from people who are against the DREAM Act is, you know, why are you letting these kids stay here and take our jobs? You know, and that's a very, very powerful feeling. And it happens, it's happened throughout history. And I think that sentiment is linked a lot to our, when the economy is bad, like it is now.
I have one of those, because I mean, net immigration now during the U.S. and Mexico is zero, right? There's as many people going back south as there are people coming north. So that would seem to maybe ease the tension a little bit, but I kind of wonder if when people are asked about immigration, if they aren't kind of answering, at least in part, as a proxy for, like, some demographic changes. It's not that they're, like, concerned with a particular immigration policy or anything. It's more about some apprehension.
They don't have to press one to hear English on it.
Yeah, right. They don't like hearing Spanish. You know, their neighborhoods are changing. And maybe, you know, there's growing competition in certain, like, sectors of the economy for jobs. It doesn't just cut across, like, you know, a nationality or citizenship, but there's just, like, there's a lot of, like, apprehension at some of the lower rungs, especially in certain sectors, though. Mm-hmm. Because it's easy to say, what you're concerned about immigration, well, what does that mean? I mean, you're concerned that we don't have a path to citizenship, or that you're concerned you don't like people coming here, or, you know.
I think that sentiment changes a lot, though, when a person who feels that way meets somebody personally who's in that situation. If you have a friend or a neighbor and you say, yeah, hey, you know, I know this guy and his, you know, they don't have documents or whatever, then I think that sentiment changes. I think when it affects them personally, or, you know, then they start to give it more thought. It becomes less of a knee-jerk reaction and more of a, you know,
well, it's okay. Just not so easy to say, I would deport them all.
Right.
Like, I'm having, there's somebody in my neighborhood, she's an American citizen, came from Mexico, and he's pretty young. He was older than 16, but he was pretty young, and they have a kid together, and they're both, like, productive citizens and everything. And, I mean, he's from a really poor and really violent-stricken part of Mexico, and he's not going back, especially now that he has a daughter here. But he can't drive, so he rides his bike everywhere, and they live in constant fear, and they keep a really low profile, both of them. And that's just the lifestyle they have to lead so they can avoid him being deported. I know a lot of people, you know, would just be like, well, he came here illegally, so screw him. But, like, that situation is so fraught with all these, you know, ties between among the family to jobs here to, like, just this, there's some rootedness now, and it's so, it's just too easy to say, well, the solution is to, like, break this family apart and deport him, and that'll solve the problem. So, but it seems like this is such a tiny little, just a tiny step forward, actually, in the grand scheme of things.
Well, and it's certainly not without its criticism. Eileen Smith wrote a post that we published today where she talks about Lamar Smith's criticism of this amnesty, and the quote she uses is, "This administration's amnesty policy is a magnet for fraud." I don't know, Melissa, do you think we're going to get 50-year-olds trying to pass as Dream Act students? Is that going
to
happen?
No, I mean, it might be a magnet for people trying to commit fraud on the Dream Act students who are trying to get their work permits. I mean, that's probably going to happen, and that's what many people fear, but how many people want to subject themselves to some long, torturous bureaucracy in trying to get a work permit that only lasts 2 years and possibly won't be renewed?
And let me tell you, illegal immigrants really love dealing with American governmental authorities. That's right. They go out of their way to file paperwork and deal with law enforcement and people in uniforms.
Yeah, they can't wait.
Well, it's like the same thing, like, though, like, well, we can't have Medicare because people try to commit Medicare fraud. Like, well, okay, that does happen. That's why you have systems in place to prevent that. So, I don't know.
Circular logic.
I do think there's something to be said, and I don't know if it's a criticism or I don't know what you would call it, but I do think there's something to be said that maybe the executive order is not the best way to go about this. Maybe it's better to build consensus over time and have the Congress take action, although the delay has been so long.
I disagree. I think they've been trying to build consensus for so long that it's like, you know, ridiculous. And I think this forces them, I hope, to do something, you know, to come to some kind of... something's got to give, because this has just been going on for, you know, it's like iceberg, you know, incremental movement, if at all, on this issue, on comprehensive immigration reform. It's just become such a dirty word among, you know, Republicans that you just can't get anywhere on it.
It's like there's a strong moral case to be made for the Dream Act, but fact is, most Americans, it's just not relevant to their personal lives, which doesn't make it any less, like, of an important thing to do. But I just think that a lot of people, it's just not, they don't know, you know, like, any of the people that would be affected by this policy for better or for worse, and they also have this abstraction in their mind about illegal immigrants sort of writ large, and these people fall into that category, so why are we doing anything for them? Unfortunately.
Well, I don't know about you guys, but I'm interested to see the way it plays out, which maybe we will have to cover in another episode. I think we'll leave it here. I'd like to thank my panelists, Melissa Del Bosque, Forrest Wilder, and Patrick Michaels. And we'll see you back here for another episode of the Texas Observer podcast in 2 weeks.
I think Patrick said anything.
He said some stuff.
Oh, okay.
I coughed Melissa's name at the beginning.
Yeah.